You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome in, Bite Me Podcast, and we are going to get right to it. John Lopez, across from me is Captain Scott Knoll and Captain Caleb McCumber. And boy, we always try to stay timely on this podcast, give you guys up-to-date information on everything from freezes to fish runs to dumps. And of course, some of the big news that is happening across the bay systems in the Gulf Coast. If you listen to us along the Gulf Coast, we really appreciate it. Very quickly, and then we'll get right into it with Shane Bonneau from CCA, the Advocacy Director for CCA Texas. And we're going to talk all things trout, redfish, limits, sunset laws, everything you have. And I know Scott and Caleb are going to have a lot of questions. Posted this on the Facebook group page, Bite Me group page, which, by the way, is the best way to get a hold of us and ask your questions, because I posted this on there. And boy, a whole string of comments came up, and we're going to get to your comments. It's going to be almost real time. People posting this, their comments and questions for Shane. We promised Shane that we would not ambush him. And so, you know, some promises are meant to be kept, some broken. So we'll see on that. But Shane, man, really, really appreciate you guys, you joining us here. But let's start with the news, if you will. Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, I guess they're going to have public forums for the limit going down to 3, or they're ongoing. You give us the update on what's happening there, the trout limit going down to 3, what led to it, what people listening can and cannot do in terms of staying informed on that and voicing their opinion. But let's just start right there. And I know Caleb and Scott and myself, we have a bunch of questions representing some 7,000 people on the group page. And last I checked, I sent you guys this email, Scott and Caleb, 117,000 plus listeners this past year to this podcast, which we really appreciate. But Shane, let's start with that right there.
Sure. And thank you guys for having me on. Happy to be here with you and discuss all things conservation and fishing. So yeah, if you've been following the winter freeze and everything that led up to it and what happened after it, this conversation has been had. As you guys, you know, discussed last year through several episodes, the freeze affected a great number of fish. And as a result of that, Parks and Wildlife implemented those emergency measures down south because they had data to justify doing that emergency action. But with that regulation, those emergency actions expire. So once they had, Parks and Wildlife had gill net data to support any additional action, they analyzed that, determined that we are seeing some pretty severe declines in our catch rates from right after the freeze as opposed to the years prior to the freeze. So with that information, they decided it was worthwhile to go forward to present that to the commission and then go out to the public and get input on this new proposal. So that new proposal is a temporary regulation change, and it's important to point that out, that this is a temporary proposal to adjust the slot size and the bag limit for speckled trout from everywhere south of Farm to Market Road 457 and Sargent. So Matagorda Bay Systems, San Antonio Bay System, Aransas Bay Complex, Corpus Christi Bay, Upper Laguna Madre, and Lower Laguna Madre. So for those bay systems, for around 18 months, you would have 17 to 23 inch slot size with the 3 fish bag limit in an effort to increase the spawning stock biomass of that specific fishery. That rule would expire August 31st, 2023. And then upon expiration, it would revert automatically back to a 5-fish bag limit and a slot size of 15 to 25 with one allowed over 25.
And so how did we get to those numbers? I want Scott and Caleb to jump in because they have some very good opinions on this. But I think the obvious question, you gave us the numbers, 17 to 23, et cetera, and the location. How did you come about that?
Well, the numbers, so the 17 to 23-inch slot size with the 3-fish bag limit is what was the commission had decided upon during that initial emergency action for the upper and lower Laguna Madre systems last year. And so they basically, in this proposal, they're just taking that and expanding it for the rest of the coast. Now, the whole point of the freeze response is to get the fishery to recover back to where it was prior to the event. And if you look at previous freeze events, 83 or 89, those had regulation changes after those freeze events. And it took about 3 years, 2 to 3 years, for catch rates to get back to where they were prior to the freeze. So this is an effort to increase the spawning stock biomass and get the fishery back to those pre-freeze levels. And then the rule would revert back to what it was before. Now, to answer your question, there's a number of different scenarios that you could have to increase the spawning stock biomass. This is just one of those options, and it's what the department is going to talk about with the commission. But at that commission meeting, although this is the proposal, and if they do adopt something, it would likely not stray from this, but they have the authority and the power to adjust it based on that exchange they have with department staff and comments from the public.
So, Kane, and it's no secret that any of us here are about conservation, and I'm all about it. I remember whenever the limit was 10 in Matagorda and they dropped it to 5, and you know, all of a sudden the sky was falling and everybody fell out. But now we have a big trout fishery that rivals Baffin, if not exceeds it. And you know, I've fished both of the systems for a long time, so I honestly trust where you are going with this. One of the questions that really jumps out that you see all the time, and it's over and over, and you may have answered it already in a roundabout way, but I kind of want to, you know, get clear on it if we can, is the decision to go with the 17 to 23s. You know, we've fought the fight so long on don't keep big fish because there are breeders. And then the science turns around and tells us, well, the big fish aren't necessarily our best breeders. Our best breeders are the, you know, the 17 to 23, 25s. And I'm going to take a shot at it here. And I'm no scientist. In fact, I haven't even been involved in the discussions. I've just been paying attention to what's going on with it. And my guess would be that we are promoting a class of fish, the 12 to 15s right now, or the 12 to 16s, or, you know, whatever it is, we're promoting that class of fish to get stronger to replace the, you know, the 17 to 23s that are being taken out. But, you know, at the same time, right now you can go catch 5 17 to 23s. Now you can only catch 3. So the weight would be lifted on them a little bit. And so that class could, the 17 and 23s could remain stronger than they would had y'all not taken action, but the smaller class of fish is going to be stronger whenever it steps up into that category. Am I anywhere close?
Yeah. So this is, think of the fishery as first of all, like a pyramid or a triangle. Mm-hmm. The base of your triangle is obviously bigger than the top of your triangle, right? So the bulk of your spawners, as far as number of eggs, are those lower size fishes. Trout start spawning around 10 to 12 inches. They spawn throughout their entire lifetime, all the way through to the point of death. But as you move up that triangle, you move up in size, but you have fewer of those fish available. So this is rebuilding the fishery from the bottom up. You could do it any number of ways, but this is just one option that's available to get the fishery back to where it was prior to the freeze. But you could make that slot size 16 to 20, 15 to 20, you know, 18 to 20, whatever. There's all sorts of different scenarios you could throw out there that achieve the same result and the same objective, which is get the fishery back to where it was prior to the freeze. There is no correct answer. There is no wrong answer. As long as we get back to the point where we were before the freeze, that should be the goal, no matter how we get there.
So that's the spawning biomass. That's the key. I'm the geek in the group. So I'll read all this stuff, and the spawning biomass is bigger at the bottom and smaller at the top is what you're saying. So
yeah,
for people who are confused about it, as far as the different scenarios that you're talking about, I don't want to go over all of them, but there's a chart. It's a really good chart that's in this month's Texas Saltwater Fishing Magazine. There's an entire article devoted to this subject. And they've got a really cool little chart there that shows the percentage of increase in spawning biomass in different scenarios with different limits, different size restrictions. And the 17 to 23 would increase it by 21.3%. And a three fish limit is 6.6%. So you add those two together and now you're at 27, you know, 27 plus. So by doing this way, they increase it by that amount. There's other scenarios in there that would increase it a lot more. So a lot faster, like a 17 to 20. But at that point, you get into such a small little window of a slot that that's really going to make people unhappy. So I think that's kind of why they went that 17 to 23 route, was to leave the window big enough where you can actually catch some keeper size fish. Am I close?
Yeah. No, you're 100% correct. That gives you a 6-inch slot size window to keep fish, and some of the other scenarios that you throw out there that give you that greater benefit to the spawning stock biomass make it extremely difficult to have fish to keep. And so I think this was well thought out by the commission during the emergency action on which option to select. And they're just carrying forward as this option for this proposed temporary regulation change. But again, at that commission meeting, that decision might adjust based upon feedback from the public.
Well, that I'm glad you brought that up. What can the public do here? I'm going to get to some points, and I know Caleb and Scott are going to want to get to some more points, and we're going to bring up flounder as well. We're talking with Shane Bonneau from the CCA Texas Advocacy Director. What are the details of what fishermen and fisherwomen can do and are able to do right now with regard to that meeting?
Yeah, so there's a good question, and it's important that people get involved. First of all, it's, you know, don't just jump on social media and complain about something. You have to
No, we're not familiar with any of that.
Submit formal comments to the department. So the opportunities to do that, you can do that online. You could do that through their public comment portal. Just go to their website at the very bottom, click public comment. It'll send you to a link, and you can find the one for proposed trout regulations. You have up until January 25th to do that. That's the easiest way to get that accomplished. The other opportunities are in person, and those are public meetings, which are being held the second week of January, the 10th through the 13th. And there's one online, which is a Zoom that's on the 10th. And then the 11th through the 13th, they are traveling along the coast from Port Isabel all the way up to Port Lavaca from 6 to 8 p.m. All those sites are on the Parks and Wildlife news release. And you can find those specific locations for those public meetings. And that's where you can see the data presented by the department and then have an opportunity to submit your public comment and ask your questions.
So you can show up and you know, raise your point. But is this happening? Is this going to happen? There's no voting it in, voting it out. You know, this is what the science says is the best for us, I guess, is the question.
The gillnet data, the catch rates on the gillnet data justify the department looking at doing something. Whether or not this specific proposal is passed as it is written, I mean, that's the commission decision at that time. I suspect that there is ample scientific data to justify doing it. I believe that there's the data to do it. I think they should do something, whether or not it's this specific thing. I don't know if that's going to occur or not. I just think that we should try to do something to help the fishery get back to where it was before the freeze.
You know, at risk of getting some people looking at me sideways, at my local academy, I couldn't agree more with what you are doing. You know, I put out reports and worked with renowned captains up and down the coast. I'm not sure if renowned is the word I'm looking for, but just trusted guys up and down the coast. And we saw the decimation, and it took 10, 12 days to really see it happen. But for that to, you know, be something that's reported, something that the guys that are out there are, you know, really scared about, and then the gill nets actually back it up, I think it was actually a relief to me, to be honest. I promise I wouldn't ambush you, and I'm just making a point here. The survey from the Parks and Wildlife, I turned over backwards in my chair. So to see the gill nets come out and show what we had initially seen, and for y'all to go ahead and take action, I think it's fantastic. Again, I'll probably get some sideways looks at Academy, but I think it's great, and hats off to you for it. Although I have a list of questions here from some of our followers that
I'm going to get to some of those, but Scott, I know you wanted to jump in on that.
Well, no, I'm not getting there now, but I'm just saying I'm on board, Shane. I want you to know that in the beginning, before I start asking these questions, because they're coming from other people.
Let me say real quick, you're giving me credit for things that aren't necessarily my doing, but
but you're plugged in, and
we don't give very many people credit on this show. So take it where you can get it, Shane.
In fact, I think that's the first time. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, I think what Shane said, he's the CCA side and not Parks and Wildlife side, correct?
That's correct, Scott. Thanks for clarifying.
So, yeah, I mean, so he doesn't have anything to do with the regulations. He's just very plugged into what the regulations are what's being proposed and what's going on. And that's why I wanted to get him on here. I just keep looking at all these different scenarios as you were talking, and that every other situation where you get a 5 to 6 inch range gives you lower biomass.
There you go.
On that deal. So that is kind of where, you know, that just kind of hit me as we were talking. And the only ones that increase the biomass significantly more than that particular slot are really tight. I mean, they're a three or four inch slot. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like snook is what came to mind. Snook, we really don't want people keeping snook. So there is a very, very tight slot. I mean, because snook are fairly rare. So there's a really, really small slot. So you can't really keep one. You know, you got to get lucky and get in that slot. And that's not what they want with the trout. They want people to still be able to keep some trout. So that's why I would believe that they are giving us a bigger slot.
Would you go with that, Shane?
Yeah, I mean, Scott's dialed in. He's very articulately described the justification and why the commission chose this slot way back during the emergency action and why the department's moving forward with this proposal now.
Well, Shane, let me get to kind of dovetail off of what Caleb was talking about. Look, this isn't an ambush. I mean, you have social media. You know, you see captains like Caleb and Scott, and I was on the water near the water when he pulled into the dock with Captain Nick Mosley, who joins this, and he was pulling out fish. He's had pictures of fish after fish after fish after fish, literally thousands. Not hundreds. I saw the biggest trout I've ever seen in my life, sadly, that he had. So you see these things. So what my point is the reports that you guys saw and that kind of led to all these to what we're talking about now. A lot of people are saying, well, it was a lot more than that. But we were talking before we came on. all you have to use is the data in front of you. That's all you can logically and legally use is the data in front of you. But I'm wondering, do you take into account and maybe err to the side of being a little more cautious and better aware of the limits because of all these posts that you see, and you see the pictures as well, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, we always have to, I think the lesson to be learned after all of this is to look at things that worked and things that didn't work. How can we improve if this happens again? How can we improve the response as anglers, as, you know, by the department, by conservation groups, all of that? So one thing that I think we've all learned during all of this is, you know, the need for some incorporation of citizen science,
right,
or opportunities for the department to engage with the public, to get out there immediately and help with, you know, that initial assessment. So we have a better idea of the impact early on in the process and not have to wait, you know, until the next round of gill nets that we're going to do to tell us where the fishery's at. So, that's one thing that I've taken away from all of this.
So what I took away from this is Shane said not to give him credit for the TPWD. So then when we were firing missiles, he's like, listen, man, wrong group, bud. And that was going to be my question is I like what not you are doing, but you were involved in, and, you know, in Texas, y'all just means everybody but me. Okay. Mm-hmm. But you know, the one thing that I personally would have loved to seen what would have been a response like last March or last April, you know, again, like John said, you need the data, you need all that. But at the end of the day, whenever you can't drive out in the East Matagorda Bay because it smells like a feedlot for the cow folks out there. I'm going to tell you, it's a terrible smell, and you can't go anywhere because there's a dead fish every 10 feet in every direction you go. You know, it would be nice to have something in place to, you know, maybe a 6-month hiatus, you know, nothing like, you know, an actual emergency thing that says, hey, we're going to pump the brakes. Before we still need a gill net to make sure what we want to do that might be a regulation that lasts 18 months, but we're going to pump the brakes for 4 months or 5 months or something like that. I think that'd be something fantastic to be in place because unfortunately, this isn't the last time we're going to see this. It looks like this is an every 10 or 15 year deal, you know, 83, 89, 90 something here recently. I just think that would be neat. And CCA being the group that they are, you know, I mean, maybe y'all could be the spearhead to get something going like that with TPWD, which you are not.
Yes, Caleb, yeah, I agree with all that. And I think the conversations that you guys personally have had with the department, I assure you that we've had similar conversations. And again, one of the things that I've learned from all of this was that there's an opportunity here to improve the initial science on these assessments. And we'd like to be engaged in that. And I know a great number of guides and folks in the fishing community would like to be engaged in that. So I think that's a good thing to do moving forward.
I know, well, Scott, go ahead, Caleb.
You know, and there's a takeaway that I'm getting from all of this and that, you know, I'm 40. I really didn't see much of the 89 freeze, the 83 freeze. We've got, you know, we've got guys like Shane that, I mean, he looks like he's about my age. And there's a lot of us that this is our first time having to deal with this, too. So it probably is hard to make those snap decisions. You know, if you're old like Scott, then you got some background. Hey, maybe we should do this. But, you know, there are guys involved that, you know, this is unprecedented grounds for us. All you can do is go back and like Shane was saying, they're looking at what has worked in the past to try to work now. So, you know, maybe it is time to, you know, Scott always says proactive is better than reactive. So maybe it's time to, you know, start planning for the next time. But, you know, there is a small window of a reason in there that there are a lot of folks that all we can do is just read about it. We didn't see it, you know.
Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, there has been a lot done since then. I mean, we've got the closed fishing areas after the freezes. We've got the I'm kind of disgusted by the ICW barge closings. that are, I thought were mandatory, but after this freeze, I learned that it was voluntary. If we could get that into a mandatory situation and shut that down, I know you're going to hear people screaming all up and down the coast that we can't shut down the petrochemical stuff because, you know, that would just wreck the economy. Well, wrecking the economy of the coast by killing all the fish isn't helping either. So I think there's still some ground to be made there. And I love the idea of the citizen scientists helping out, you know, people with a stake in this game, being able to put your biologist on the boat, those young biologists that were driving around that didn't know where they were going. I know there was, there was several of those around Galveston. I directed them straight to a spot where I had video from a friend of dead fish. I mean, just tons and tons of dead fish on the bottom in a canal, and the water was super clear and they could see them, and they videoed them, and that video ended up getting out there. But I turned it into Parks and Wildlife and said, here, y'all need to go take a look at this. This is a major kill in Galveston. They contacted me back and said, we can't find it. We can't find anything. if we need to get out there and hold them by the hand and show them, because we know the bay, we know everything about it. I get it. They're young kids out of college. They may not have ever been around Galveston Bay. That's just where they got assigned. So they don't know Sea Isle from Jamaica Beach, you know, and all the different little communities along there where those canals are. That would help tremendously, I think, if we could get them out. And like getting out on Caleb's boat in East Matagorda Bay, instead of those guys just going out and kind of wandering around that may not have even known what the area was and where to look for the big trout. These guys, they fish for them all the time. They know the areas. They went straight to the areas where they've caught big trout, and that's where they found the majority of their dead trout. So I think what that would be awesome, Shane? if CCA could get that going.
That symbiotic relationship that Scott's talking about, is that something that – and you guys are the conduit. I mean, CCA and CCA Texas, you're the conduit to the federal organizations.
Yeah, I mean – If you look at other natural resources, take birds, for example, and the data that's collected on birds, there's websites and there's programs, there's eBird, there's people that are trained to identify these different species and they can report them, and all that information gets generated to help population assessments. You know, we could be doing the same sort of thing with fish kills, whether it be from a freeze or from an algal bloom or a spill or what have you, environmental disaster, you know, we could be out there participating in that process. I think it's a great opportunity for CCA and for all participants in the recreational fishing community to be involved in. So yeah, we'll be having those discussions.
All right, Shane. So let me get, I opened up the Facebook group page, and we have a really good group. They're asking very respectful questions, but there are questions that I know people listening to this podcast across the country want to hear answers to the best of your knowledge and your relationship with Texas Parks and Wildlife. The first one I mentioned earlier, I may be wrong, but I don't think TPWD has ever let something sunset. There's variations of that. And I think it's inaccurate. Scott and I have talked about this, but you know, people who are wary of, you know, this happening for 18 months and then it just extends. What would be your thoughts on that?
No, that's a legitimate concern. And the way that those previous rules, I think, were written, let's say going from 10 fish to 5 fish, for example, back for the Middle Coast, it was written that this rule can sunset at, you know, after 5 years or whatever the time period was. So with the sunset provision, the commission has the authority to extend it. It's the way that this rule is written, it's actually in the preamble that if the rule passes, the rule automatically expires August 31st, 2023. So if you read the proposal before you get your comment, you should read this whole thing. But the last bulleted item in this proposal was that the provisions of this section cease effect August 31, 2023. So if they adopt the rule the way it's written, it automatically, it is not a sunset. It is an expiration. It yeah. is done at the end of August 2023.
What people need to remember while they're worried about all of this is that, you know, there's a big perception out there that this is going to hurt the guiding industry. People aren't going to want to fish anymore and all this kind of whatnot. Texas Parks and Wildlife a lot of their funding comes from selling fishing licenses. So if it's a big negative impact on the recreational guys and the guides, I pay $300 a year for my license. And it's taking money out of their pocket. So if it's good for the resource and it helps us bounce back and it helps it be better so that the population isn't depleted and people, you know, continue to enjoy the fish like they do here in Texas, it's beneficial for everybody.
Yeah. And Scott, I know you want to say something, but Shane, just real quick, Scott and Caleb and I say this all the time. The whole purpose of this podcast is for people to catch a lot of fish and to help people catch a lot of fish. I personally want to catch all the fish and then release them, you know? And so it's not, a lot of times people look at this as like a restriction where really it's more of a, you know, from your perspective in CCAs, it's more of a, guys, we want you to do this more often and enjoy more of it. Correct?
Right. I mean, we want to have the ability to access the fish on opportunities to catch them. And we want the fishery to improve, to get better. So that's the whole goal of this proposal by the department is to, and it achieves both of those objectives. So that's why we came out in support of the proposal. And we also caveat that in saying that we'd support any proposal that would achieve equivalent results.
Couple of things that came up there. As far as the not giving back redfish, I mean, that's a prime example. They put a moratorium on bull redfish when the population got back to where it was self-sustaining. They gave us a tag. They gave us two tags. The other part was they cut the limit to three. There was a proposal that got floated out just like this proposal is here for public discussion of going up to five, you know, returning back to five fish. And it was shot down by the public. The public was like, man, this three fish thing's working. Let's just keep rolling with it. And that was pretty much common, you know, the common feeling among everybody. The other side of that is I've been there from the time when we had no limits. You know, I've said it on here. And I ain't proud of it. I kept 52 trout the last day that there was no limits. Once their limits came in, everybody kept all these guides, everybody, man, nobody's going on fish if we can only keep 20. Well, more people started fishing. Now it went to 10. Man, all the guides, everybody all up and down the coast. Oh my God, I'm going to go broke. Nobody's going to want to come pay me to go fishing to keep 10 fish. Guess what? There's more guides now than there ever was before. Same thing with five fish. It's not going to change.
Yeah.
As we go to three fish, there's still going to be just as many guides, if not more. There's going to be more people participating. If the fishery gets stronger and better, more people want to fish more often. That's the way I look at all the conservation.
Now, I'll go every day in November. June is a little bit tougher to get me out there every day. Yeah, you know, we're catching more fish. You know, Scott said something earlier, and then John said something that kind of resonated with it. Scott said that we drove out to an area that we knew there would be big fish at after the freeze to find them because we've been catching them there. And I want to clarify, we thought we had been catching the big fish. We were not catching the big fish. Like I've said before, the only thing we found out when we got there is that corky suck because there were some massively big fish there that Pat, Nick, and I never even got to look
that
at.
That one that Nick had, Caleb, I mean, it looked like a freaking king salmon.
Oh, yeah. When you're riding around and you quit looking at the eights and nines because the big fish are floating beside them, it was devastating, but like I've said before, I kind of looked at that 11.5-pound fish and said, serves you right, you know. Take that.
You need a 10 to 11-inch corky is what you need.
Yeah, that's exactly.
You know, there was
quite
a bunch
an ego
of,
check.
Yeah.
There was a bunch of them out there that had about a 10-inch mullet hanging out of their neck, and Nick was just joking when he said it, but he said, "Man, next time it freezes, I'm gonna be standing out here with a 10-inch mullet on a circle hook, grinning like a kid at the carnival, just waiting."
Hey, real quick, Shane, how did you land on eight? How did TPWD, from your information, land on 18 months?
So I think that's just a function of what they've learned from the previous events and looking at how quickly the catch rates recovered in their gill nets from the 83 and the 89 freeze. After the first event in 83, I think it took a little over 2 years for their gill net catch rates to get back to the word before the freeze. And then in 89, I think it took 3 years. So their thought process, I suspect, is that once this rule expires, we would have been 2 to 3 years removed from the event, and the gill net catch rates should get back up to where they were prior to the freeze event.
Scott, yeah, I want to go to you next, but I have one more question here that I didn't get to from our group page on Facebook. And I know you've heard variations of this, Shane. Well, why doesn't Louisiana do it? They've had hurricanes, they've had weather events, they've had freezes. That, first of all, I mean, I can answer the first part, but I want to get your thoughts. This ain't Louisiana. I mean, we don't control Louisiana, but your thoughts on that question that is predominant out there.
Yeah, sure. I need to find the link for it, and maybe I could share it with you and you could post it on Facebook, but there is a link that shows the Louisiana, that gives an updated information on the Louisiana trout fishery. And you could easily say that, perhaps Louisiana should be doing something about their speckled trout populations, specifically to their size dynamics. They're different situation, different state, different ways that folks target that fishery, different things they want to get out of that fishery. So we'll just focus here on Texas and then let them figure that out another time.
Yeah, one of the questions I have on mine is, why is our trout limit so wildly different than Louisiana? And I think that all four of us can answer that pretty well. And the fact that half of our state is in an estuary like Louisiana is. Like you just brought up, there was a time not too long ago that all you heard about was catching trout in Big Lake, catching trout in Big Lake. The monsters are there. And boy, the people showed up and went to catching them. And my early experiences when I first started guiding, I was kind of getting around and exploring around. And me and some buddies, we decided we were going to go to the Burge, the casino. We were going to fish the next day. And I went to Big Lake and, believe it or not, I went to Redfish, but whenever I got back to the cleaning table, the first thing that really blew my mind, this is before all the, all the filet-zalls and everything, there was a dude there with a sawzall, I mean, a legit Makita, and just had a blade just jammed in this sucker, and he is running through fish, and it blew me away. More so, the part that got my attention was he was running through 28-inch trout with this thing, just zat, zat, zat. I mean, he had 6, 8, 9 of them just laying on the table, just cleaning them as fast as they could. So I think we're spot on. And people from Louisiana, I have a lot of friends over there that I tournament fish against, that I hang out with, I talk to, and the serious guys over there that want a trout fishery want more regulation over there. When you go catch a 17-inch trout in Calcasieu, or really, I'm being unfair, but the Calcasieu area, and people are like, man, that's a good one. And yeah, it kind of blows my mind at the turn that their fishery is taking and has taken. And, again, I don't think that it's a negative that they have, you can catch more and smaller fish over there than you can here.
Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, same thing. I went to Calcasieu during all that big trout when everybody was like, oh my God, there's big trout in Calcasieu. Got to go over there. I went over there. And I was staying in a little hotel, and me and my buddy walked out there, and there's a boat pulls up and they're pulling trout out, and they had 5 trout that were between 28 and 31 inches in their cooler. And they were just filleting them just like, there was no, we're going to have this thing mounted. There was nothing like that. It was just, we're just going to, just make fillets out of this. And it, it was so backwards to what I've grown up with. And yeah, it was really kind of bizarre. It was strange to see and watch it. And at that moment, I looked at my buddy and I said, their trout fishery is going to crash. It can't sustain this.
You know, and that's a testament for whenever we, and I don't work for TWD, but I'm going to say whenever we dropped the limit from 10 to 5, it had a lot to do with the amount of pressure that we were seeing on the fish. You know, you've got the fishing is becoming a cooler thing to do. There's more people that have the means to do it. You've got social media not only making it cool, but you've got these dang podcasts and YouTubers teaching people how to catch them, right? So, you know, you go back to what Scott was saying, because I would imagine, what was that, like 47 when you were there, Scott? Big Lake? 47, 48?
Right after the war. Right after the big one.
Yeah, they were still rounding up Nazis in Argentina, I'm sure. But those guys, you know, they've been catching those big trout for eons, right? I mean, it wasn't like the locals just discovered them there, but the word of mouth got out and more people showed up and started hammering on them. And there were no measures taken to try to protect that. And I, you know, in my humble opinion, I feel like that is a testament for the way that Texas Parks and Wildlife is responding. And, you know, like Scott always says, proactive is better than reactive.
So, Shane, it's not just about this, and I'm glad that we have you on. Caleb and Scott and I have put on our biology hats and the best we can and talked about the oyster fishery here. And I know you have some great information that's near and dear to your heart. But some of the things going on with the oystering up and down the coast, what would be your number one message there?
Well, first of all, John, thanks for jumping into this subject. And this is probably something that is going to require lengthy discussions. But
well, we can have you back on, but give us your best
okay.
shot.
Okay. So we have too many boats and not enough oysters. I mean, if you want to just boil it down to the state of the fishery in right now today, that's the situation that we're in. We've, as y'all discussed in the past on previous episodes, Hurricane Ike wiped out Galveston Bay. And the question everybody should be asking what happened with the Galveston Bay oyster fishery is, how did that happen? Well, the reefs got silted over. And then the next question you should ask is, why were the reefs vulnerable to being silted over? And the answer is that the reefs have been dredged and dragged down to where they have very little vertical relief. So they're coming off the bay bottom just a few inches rather than feet as the way reefs should be. So what happened in Galveston Bay, the concern is that's going to happen further down along the middle coast, the coastal bend area. And so there's a pretty big initiative right now and working with the department, with the commission and with the oyster industry to try to get that thing rectified and help our public reefs get back to where they need to be.
Go ahead, Scott. I know you got more on this.
Yeah, the oyster thing, I've watched it all up and down the coast. I've seen massive oyster reefs in Galveston Bay just get reduced to nothing. Same thing's happening here. First Chain Islands is not anything near what it used to be. I just hate seeing it continue on. And that's the part that a lot of people don't quite get. Is, well, the oysters are regenerating, you know, everything's fine. But by taking the top off over and over and over again, what you got people out there, picture a big hill and where he's talking about a relief, picture a big hill that's in 5 feet of water and the oysters come up to the top. Well, now they've knocked off the top, and now it's only a foot tall. And then the hurricane happens, and instead of covering up the base and the edges, now it can cover the entire oyster reef, which basically smothers it. I think I'm pretty much correct on that. And also the way that they do the oystering, they pull them up, and if they're not of the right size, they dump them back in. Well, they don't dump them back on top of where they dredged them. Now they're 30, 40 yards over. They're off the reef. Now it gets scattered onto a floor of the bay where they're not a part of the original reef. It scatters the reef out. It makes it bigger width-wise, but it doesn't return it back to being tall.
Yeah. Go ahead, Shane. Your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Scott's absolutely right. You've compromised the reef integrity. Think of the reef as a complex structure that's all woven together almost like rocks within a cement mix. I mean, that's what the reef is. When you break all of that up, that reef can be scattered with wave action, with storm action. It's no longer a single unit. It gets blown across the bay bottom. So that gets covered up with mud. There's no place for the new oyster larvae to set in. And so we have to think of reefs as a critical part of that underwater landscape, no different than trees of the Piney Woods or the brush of South Texas plains or the wooded mountains of the Trans-Pecos. You imagine taking those things away from those habitats. We would never allow that to happen, but yet that's what we're doing to the bottom of our bays.
We'll talk about what it means for the fishery right now and why it is a state of, I'm not going to say emergency, but certainly urgency, isn't it?
It's important. There's over 303 different aquatic species that either use oyster reefs for fish habitat or refuge. The reefs are our coral reefs. Oyster reefs are our bay systems, coral reefs. So could you imagine an industry out there on the flower banks off of Galveston harvesting coral and no one care about it? I mean, come on. That's basically what's happened within our bay system. So we want this fishery to improve. I love oysters. I know you guys likely do as well. So we need to be able to provide opportunities to grow oysters and relieve pressure on our public reefs at the same time.
So you got me thinking now, because I was in East Matagorda Bay a couple of years ago. I was fishing right inside the old Gulf Cut there, and somebody's going to be looking for that on Google Earth. But I was fishing right there where I could see all the boats coming in and out, and an army of oyster boats come in. They take off towards the west end where a lot of our reefs are in East Matagorda Bay. And boy, I tell you what, they went and got on top of a couple of good ones, and they're just rolling in circles, man, rolling in circles. And the thing about East Matagorda Bay is that's pretty much all you have as far as structure in that bay is oyster. So, and I can't imagine trying to keep up with those fish in that bay without at least having that fallback plan. Which kind of leads me to my next point, and I'm gonna shift gears on the oyster thing if that's okay, because you know, like you said, it's a whole
episode worth talking.
But is there a possibility or something that, you know, those of us here local would be willing to contribute to or help with? Is there any kind of method to introduce seagrass back to East Matagorda Bay? Because that's something I've always, man, I'll go out there and I'll work 7 days straight if it involves running my boat back and forth and, you know, seeding or planting. Or I've even thought about going to West Bay, getting grass and bringing it to East Bay and making my own little secret grass spots here and there. Because I fished East Bay back whenever you couldn't throw a quirky in a lot of the coves. It was so thick. And it sure seemed like the fishing there was a lot better then than it is now.
Well, those two subjects are likely highly interrelated in that, what does the grass need? The grass needs sunlight. How do you get sunlight? You need water clarity, right? So if you remove your reefs, you have more turbid water, you have less sunlight able to reach the seagrass and its growth. So seagrass does come and go. It's a highly seasonal thing. It's influenced by much more than just sunlight penetration. But I guarantee you, if you allow the reefs to get back to where they were, if you clean up your water clarity, you will have more seagrass back in East Matagorda Bay. So that's one of the things that reefs provide other than cleaning the water. They break up the waves. So then again, more sunlight is able to penetrate in greater depths and helps that grass grow. All these things are related.
So, yeah, it seems like it's a never ending circle there where, you know, now that our grass is gone, and I don't know if you've been to East Matagorda Bay, but I mean, they're just not grass in the main bay, right? And so, you know, anybody that fishes quite a bit, the grass, you know, when you find grass, you can usually find cleaner water because the grass is kind of filtering it itself. And then you've got the oysters, and they're kind of, you know, they're keeping the bay clean together. You know, it's a synergetic relationship there. That's a big word. I think
that's pretty good. I'm impressed.
Yeah.
And I'm in the business.
But yeah, so I mean, it makes my head hurt to think that, well, okay, I need clear water to get grass. Well, our oysters are getting slammed and we don't have the grass already to help filter it. So, you know, what's the next step? What can we do? And it seems like, you know, because these reefs will grow back. Am I correct? I mean, if you leave them alone, they've got to grow back.
If you have the structure in the water for the oyster larvae to set on, they will come back. It'll just take several generations of of oyster set to get it back to where it was. So the recovery won't be 2 or 3 years. That's a little bit longer time period.
Go ahead, Scott.
So, I've watched East Matagorda Bay go through that as well. I used to fish it quite a bit, poling. It's not that long ago that there was grass. And that's what worries me about Port O'Connor and Rockport so much, is having watched that happen in East Bay in Matagorda, the exact same thing could happen over here. And that's what Port O'Connor, Rockport, Port Aransas, that's what that whole area is known for, is fishing the grass.
Yeah.
It's not so much about fishing the oysters, but fishing those grass beds. And I would sure hate to see those, you know, that that same scenario take place here in Port O'Connor. It would ruin us. I think it would really wreck the place.
So one topic that's came up many times on this show and almost daily on my boat is what killed our grass. Has there been any, like, you know, scientific research into what did it, besides, you know, me and Nick arguing over what, you know, have smart people looked at this?
That's what he's saying. That's what he's asking. Yeah.
East Matagorda Bay specific, there probably hasn't been an assessment done to try to determine what the stocks were prior, you know, over a historical time series. So, short answer is I highly doubt it. But that's a good thing for a research institute to take up. And some of that stuff they can do now with some of the fancy mapping tools that we have. I will say that you can go to, I think it's Matagorda Bay Assessment, the study commissioned by, I believe, the General Land Office, and they've working with Hart Research Institute, and they are looking at Matagorda Bay, not East Matagorda, but Matagorda Bay proper, and do an entire ecosystem assessment of that bay system, which does include seagrass and ways to help it and restore it. So that's a long way of answering your question of saying no, but there's something similar going on.
Let me ask you this, Shane, because, you know, we're talking about some of the things going on that we want the fishery to recover from. You are advocacy director of CCA Texas. So I can just sense all the listeners to this week's podcast are saying, well, man, you know, that's good information. What can I do? You know, what is the advocacy right now for all these things? I mean, take your time. Tell us, you know, whether it's, you know, we talked about the trout limitations, but oysters, seagrass, you know, what are some of the things right now that you would highly recommend people can do?
Get active. I mean, join a group that helps promote the things that you value. So if it's specific to Matagorda Bay, join the Matagorda Bay Foundation. Help Bill Balboa and his team with that group and get involved in what they're doing to work directly in Matagorda Bay. If it's more of a coastwide thing and you like what CCA is about and want to support habitat projects that we're going to be doing, you join CCA, do something to where you don't have the time, you don't have the energy to participate directly into something, at least if you have the funds to donate to these different groups. And again, it could be Galveston Bay, CCA, Matagorda Bay, wherever. Help those groups do the work that you want to see done.
So is there a group where I can, you know, I I'm willing to show up and work. I'm willing to burn my gas, do what, say we're planting seagrass or something. You said something earlier about, you know, don't get on Facebook and complain about it. Go to the meeting, right? I'm all about going to the meetings and saying, yes, we should do this, right? But are there groups out there that I can actually show up and, you know, do the work, do something to make things better versus just, you know, voting yes that we should do it?
Yeah. Well, so specific to your question, in Matagorda Bay, our Matagorda Bay CCA chapter is very active, and they do the type of things that you're talking about. They haven't done seagrass planting, but they have done shoreline protection with oyster shells, bagging oyster shells, deploying them along the shores of Karankwa Bay on the Matagorda Bay side, and trying to protect their shoreline. So they do things like that. So you just have to find local groups in your areas that you care about and get involved. And if you see that they're not actually doing something that you'd like to see to be done, volunteer for their board and you do it. You lead the initiative and get it done. But specific to you, Caleb, that CCA group would suit you well, I think.
All right, great.
Yeah, I've done it with Galveston Bay Foundation. We went out and planted seagrass, or not seagrass, but cordgrass in them back marshes and doing some marsh restoration stuff. There's a lot of hands-on stuff that you can do if you're willing to get out there and do the work. Something else, I mean, we'd be remiss if we didn't get into would be your association with the hatcheries. I hear that all the time about, well, what about,
man, I'm
what
glad
about,
you brought that up. I forgot.
What about using hatcheries to increase the trout? And it's my understanding that trout are just so cannibalistic that it's difficult to produce a lot of trout the way that we produce redfish. I know you're way off into the hatchery side of things. I feel like we'd miss it if we didn't hit you up for that.
Yeah, good point. And to that point, CCA, as I think y'all covered in a previous episode, we donated $152,000 to the hatcheries right after the freeze to help them respond and increase their speckled trout production this past year or in 2020. So in 2020, they released just over 10 million speckled trout and around 15 million red drum. They can adjust those trout numbers one way or the other. They would just need more brood stock to do so, and they would have to sacrifice some of their red drum production to do so. So they had the capabilities to produce more trout if needed, but we've come a long ways in the last 10 to 15 years from not producing any speckled sea trout for the Texas coast to now producing 10 to 12 million every single year from Sabine Lake all the way down to the lower Laguna Madre.
And I just thought...
We've hit on something on that before. You and I talked about it, not on a podcast or anything. The percentage of fish that y'all find in the surveys later, what is the percentage of our fish that have come from hatcheries?
Well, they haven't done it for trout, but for red drum specifically, they've done it through genetic markers, so basically DNA testing, and they had anywhere from less than 1% all the way up to close to 20%. It's just highly variable upon specific stockings and bay systems. So if a bay system's already healthy and has a bunch of fish already in it, there's no room for the hatchery fish to recruit to. But if that bay system has a void, then those hatchery fish will recruit and you'll have better survival. But we just say close to 20% is what you can expect on a good year.
That's cool.
And I just thought of what I'm going to volunteer to do. I'm going to volunteer to take extra redfish out and release them for it's for you, Shane. You let me know how many redfish I have. I'm going to go release them. But the point that I wanted to make is, you know, we have a lot of people that listen to this podcast. We have a lot of people that are local to it. And I see a lot of these guys that they, you know, they go out on a boat or they're walk-in waders or something. And every one of them, you know, they'll make the post about, you know, just how much they just like being out there and how pretty it is and all that kind of whatnot. And even specifically the guys that don't have a boat that would like to go see the marsh systems and the bay systems and hang out. If you volunteer to help plant grass or something, you will get a free boat ride. You know,
that's right.
Seriously, it's something that, you know, if you want to dedicate a weekend or two to just go hanging out on the bay with good folks and seeing some cool stuff, then, hey, I think it'd be great to look into who you could join up with and who you could work with.
Yeah. And to that point, the department, you know, we have the crab trap cleanup coming up here in February. So that's another good opportunity to get involved, get your feet wet, go do something good for the resource. That's a middle of February typically is the date for that.
And Shane, man, we could do a whole other show and we will. But I do want to just bring one more point up. Us, what we do, we fish all the time, just about every chance that we can. There is that. We haven't even mentioned that, you know, release your fish, you know, be careful around the oysters, report, you know, over, you know, any problems that you might see with all that. I mean, CCA, I just mentioned it. We want people to catch fish, but we have that responsibility as fishermen. Everybody listening to this podcast, I mean, just your thoughts on what, you know, all your members, all members like us can do to just do the little things, our own little part to help everything from trout to flounder, which we haven't even really touched on today, but we will. at some point in the future, you know, to the oysters, to the seagrass, you know, what does CCA recommend, and especially you as the director of advocacy?
Yeah, certainly as individuals, we're a pretty powerful group, right? We don't think of ourselves as being that powerful, but we are, and our collective actions have an impact. So, well, like you mentioned, fish handling. Think like a fish. You don't want to be out of the water that long. You don't want to be held vertically for your guts to fall down, lower in your body cavity and be stretched to where they can't recover from. So think about all these things while you're handling fish. Only keep what you need to eat. Let the rest go. You know, we've been talking about this message for a while, certainly before the freeze and afterwards. But think about your actions on the water and just remember it's not just you out there. There's several hundred thousand of us doing the same things you're doing. So try to lead by example.
Listen, man, I feel like we just barely touched the surface with you, but we are going to move on to, you know, the podcast. We like to keep it around an hour. We always go over a little bit. So we're going to go over a little bit with our What Would Scott Do and What Would Caleb Do segment that people always look forward to this week. We have so many other topics that we'll get to next week. In fact, I just got two as I'm sitting here recording this podcast with you. We're gonna get to a lot of topics. But before we let you go, Scott, I think you had one more thing.
No.
Oh, I thought you raised your hand.
No, I was grabbing my phone to look at
He was just showing off that his shoulder works a little bit.
His
again.
His shoulder's a little better now.
Look at that.
But Shane, we reserve the right to get you on for another hour because this was fantastic. But we are going to get into just the last 10 minutes here. Some things. You're welcome to hang out. You're welcome to go ahead and jump off. But thank you very much for coming on. This is great information. And I'm telling you, I said at the beginning, we have thousands and thousands of people that listen to this podcast. So your voice will be heard. I appreciate it.
No, thanks for the opportunity. And I'd like to jump on anytime and help spread awareness and the message of conservation. So thanks, guys.
All right. We answered a lot of questions and have a lot more. All right, Scott, I'm going to start with you. This was a topic, but let's just put it in with the What Would Scott Do, What Would Caleb Do segment here. Enormous dump, dangerous dump. I saw you posting about that. Be careful. But in the wake of that, let's get some fishermen that are listening on some fish. What would Scott do in the wake of pretty brutal winds, pretty brutal dump up and down the Gulf Coast?
One of the good fly fishing guides around here, Jack Campbell, just put on Facebook the other day, epic day. I think it was yesterday.
Really?
They had fish from 29 to 30 inches, like I think he said over 40, fly fishing.
My goodness.
Days like that behind those fronts when it settles out and it calms down and the high pressure's there and everything's nice and clear and you can see the fish. And it takes a day or two after the dump, at least 24 hours. They feed so hard during that dump that I just don't think that they're hungry.
Yeah.
They're sitting around, you know, you can just see them sitting around rubbing their bellies. But that two or three days after, they're getting hungry again, and the bait fish are more scarce. And with the colder water temperatures, you can get that just awesome, awesome feed. And the fish are kind of gathered up because they're in pockets where there's deep enough water while you've got this low tide hanging out. Everybody saw pictures.
Yeah.
Of Galveston beachfront and all the different places, there was no water. It was gone. So think like the fish, and they're going to go to a refuge, and the refuge is going to be that little bit deeper water, and fish around the edges of that. As this warming trend comes back behind that front, they're going to move back up onto the shallows as that water comes back up. So I would fish.
Go ahead.
Wade fish or bolt poling or whatever, the shallow water near deeper holes.
We got into such a good conversation with Shane. I didn't get to, and I always like to do this every week, mention, Caleb, before we get to you, the great promos that our friends are all offering. Let me mention those right now, because I was talking with I was talking with Paul Falgu from Deadly Dudley, and he was giving me a thumbs up because that big trout that I had, I got the mount back this week. A lot of people were asking, well, what'd you catch on it? It was my first 30, first mount. I said, I caught it on that Deadly Dudley electric chicken, believe it or not, the little 3-inch one, even not the 5-inch. And he said, he gave me an attaboy, and I said, well, it works. So deadlydudley.com. You can use bite me 20 at deadlydudley.com. One word, bite me, and then the number's 20 to get on there. But we absolutely need to mention our other friends that have these great promos as well. Knock and Tail. I was talking with Mike Krulik as well this week, and they've been doing, he got an order from Indiana. The podcast listener in Indiana used the Bite Me 20 promo code. So that's My Coast Outdoors. I love those as well. You guys know that, especially getting under some birds or getting low in the water column with the Knock and Tail lures. You can use that at My Coast Outdoors, Bite Me 20. And then, of course, our big buddies that we all use this product and swear by it. It's the Wade Wright Belt. They have the Bite Me group package, which includes everything. The Madre Sling, which I use a lot, but I also use when I go serious wading. The Wade Wright Belt has all kinds of other goodies in there. So you can go to coastalfishinggear.com. You can watch an instructional video there on how to really get the most out of it. And they have the Bite Me 20 promo code as well. So I wanted to absolutely mention those guys because we've got a lot of questions. I was chatting them up this week. We'll go from there. Next week, of course, we're going to have all those topics that we missed. We're going to talk to JT Koshy over at the Boatyard on some really good. It's a really good topic. I already recorded this one, but we're not going to get to it this week, on how to actually test a boat. A lot of people, you know, kind of in essence, just kick the tires, so to speak, and they like the way a boat looks, and that could be a big mistake. We're going to get all that next week. But Caleb, I don't know exactly how much fishing you did during, post, well, not during, hopefully, but post front and in the next few days you have. But I know you guys have been on them. I know Patrick's been on them. What would Caleb do if our guys go out this weekend?
Yeah, I haven't done a whole lot. Holidays before it, during it, had stuff going on. And then I didn't really go after it. I had several friends that did. They said it was terrible. And I was watching it. And really the one thing I could really stay consistent with was that barometer was really high.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Scott. You know, no, I'm just kidding. Yeah. We had this last discussion.
I'm just telling you, the redfish guys said Jack's an old timer, and he said it was epic.
Wow. Well, because again, redfish are the cool ones. All right, nobody is arguing that factor. This weekend, I have customers Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I think tomorrow also. I am going to. What I'm going to be doing is I am going to take advantage of hopefully some sunny skies like the forecast is showing. This front came in. It was cold. There's a lot of wind. It got the water column at the bottom probably got cooler than it would have if there's no wind. Got some sun coming out. Got some barometer drops, ups and downs, which don't matter, right, Scott? I'm going to go out and I'm going to find shallow water where hopefully these fish have sucked up and are laying there getting a little bit of sun, and I'm gonna throw my quirkies at them and see if we can't get them to eat. I'm not gonna go too long on this, but
go ahead. We already busted the hour. We're good.
I've seen a lot of posts on Facebook, especially like while it was just frigid cold, about, man, now it's time, we should be out there right now looking for a trout. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I like to kind of hang out, let everybody else freeze. And then a couple of days after, when that sun's out warming up the flats, that's whenever I like to slip out there. I'm not as angry at them as some people are, but that's a low hanging fruit to me.
Yeah. It's also a different strategy. And ScottNullPhotography.com for your photos. And of course, all the Bite Me gear. I'm guessing we're still good on that. What does Camille, the boss, have to say about that?
Yeah, we're still stocked up pretty good. And she told me the other day, I think I got 10 more calendars left.
Oh, nice.
If I'm not mistaken. Nice. 9 or 10.
Good deal.
We still got some of that going on, too.
All right. And Captain Caleb TV, you said you were working all day on a video. What can we expect?
Man, we're back and rolling again. I took a bunch of footage yesterday. And
on YouTube, by the way.
Yes, on YouTube. I took a bunch of footage yesterday. I've got to edit it, put it together. I'll release that tomorrow. And it's kind of what I'm doing is kind of giving us a roadmap of what to expect this year. Unfortunately, I did a whole video about what to expect. And I think I don't even know what to expect. We're still going to do the teaching stuff, but I want to do some destination fishing and I want to do some behind the scenes stuff. My thing, the reason I guide like I do and do YouTube and do Bite Me is because I like, interacting with people, and I wanted to become more of a personal feel than it already is. So, you know, that's kind of what we're working on this week, and then next week, who knows what happens.
Last thing before we get out of here for both of you guys, the one thing I like about our podcast is we're all three different types of fishermen. We all fish for the same things, but you know, Scott has been doing this a long time and has that knowledge and is an amateur biologist and everything, you know, his geeky stuff as he self-proclaimed there. I fish, I'm the heavy duty. I'm not necessarily a weekender and I'm not a guide. I'm somewhere in between. I just fish every chance I get. And of course, Caleb is the younger guy that fishes, you know, all the time and is instructional. And I think it works for this podcast, but I also think it works for this point before we get out of here. Scott, I'll start with you. What would be your big takeaway from the conversation with Shane Bonneau? Because I thought we all, you know, I think everybody kind of falls into one category like you, me, or Caleb. What would be the message that really needs to be taken away from that?
To get involved. I hear it so often. What does CCA do? All they do is collect money. You know, it's about people lining their pockets. It's not. I've been involved with CCA from the very beginning of it. I mean, when Mr. Fondren was talking to Mr. Marburger about it, I got to sit there and listen and hear the bits and pieces of this new organization that they were putting together. They do a lot of good for all of us. All the habitat stuff, all the hatchery stuff. But if you can get involved by hands-on, I think you'll get even more out of it. You can get out there, like you said, putting out sacks of oysters, doing restoration stuff. Every area up and down the coast has a CCA chapter. And if you get involved with those, I think you'll find that it's a much better organization than some people lead you to believe.
I'd probably, you know, my macro perspective on all of it is every question that we sent to him, you know, they seem to have their thumb on it. They seem to, you know, have just an overall consensus of what's going on out there. And to me, that would lead me to believe that I would, if they're saying that, you know, the proposed changes are what they think is going to be best, they've done a pretty darn good job with our ecosystem. I mean, there's very few people can argue that Texas, if you want to go catch good redfish, good trout, good flounder, you know, it's a place to be. And so, you know, maybe give them a break and you know, let them do their job. The man said that it's going to last 18 months, then it's going to cut off. That's my takeaway on it. You know, let them work. They've made our trout bigger. You know, they've done a lot of cool stuff. Like Scott said, get involved. I'm definitely going to look into it. I think we have several listeners out there that are probably going to be real interested in it too.
I'm glad you mentioned that last part, because that would be my takeaway. I took it almost like on a personal level, because I want to keep catching fish, as we've mentioned several times here. But I had two kids married this year, and I'm getting another kid married next year. All three of my kids are going to be married in about a year and a half span. So that means I'm going to have grandkids at some point. And I was thinking about that. I want my grandkids to be able to see the grass and the oysters that I saw when I was a kid and catch the big fish that I caught and have been catching. And also this, what Caleb was talking about, it went to 5 in East Matagorda Bay. That's the entire reason. Well, you know, in the lower coast and mid coast, but anyway, that's the entire reason I moved from Sabine, my trailer, back to East Matagorda Bay. I like catching big fish, and pre-freeze, I was catching some big old trout, man, and I love that. So I was kind of taking it on a personal level, almost all this, you know, we can all do some of these things and maybe flex a little bit, bend a little bit, and be able to have, you know, our grand, not to get too mushy here, but, you know, I want my grandkids. Scott, you have grandkids. I mean, that's what I was thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I built my lake, was so my kids could catch a lot of fish, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm all about watching them do their thing now. Had a friend down this weekend, had his little 11-year-old daughter out fishing, and we went just sat on the pier down at the end of the road, and she caught some little croaker and just had a blast doing it. It's so much fun to watch the kids do what I did growing up.
Yeah. All right, boys, we can go on and on, but we're already busting it way long. I'm sure our listeners won't mind, because it was just such a good episode. We'll get Shane Bonneau on again. We'll get to all those topics. I got a whole list of topics here I sent you guys, and I got more coming. So we're not going to be
actually
wanting
notes on all that too.
You did some notes.
Yeah, I actually had notes.
You're ahead of the game for next week.
I was prepared to answer questions.
Yeah, we're going to have them next week. We'll have the podcast again. Until then, I hope everybody has a great time. Take this information that you got and use it how you will, and hopefully you use it in a way that will make us all catch and help us all catch a lot more fish in the future. You guys are the best. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, iTunes, Spotify, etc., pretty much anywhere. Join the group page. Send us your questions. And we'll get you all that other stuff next week. But until then, catch them up, and we will talk to you next time.